Start off by thanking the organizers for asking me to come out and talk to you about this. So this is the, again, I think I was reminded at lunch, this is the producer application section, and we're going to talk about how to use some DNA tools for these defects, but I think also this is an opportunity for perhaps taking some of the information that some of you might have heard yesterday and providing an idea of how immediately some of those tools can be applied to some more simple traits that that we can work on quite easily with these new tools. And so the goal here today is one to give you a background and tell you why maybe it's important to try to manage these genetic defects. Two, a little bit take a little bit of the mystery out about what it is we do when we actually develop DNA markers, and hopefully demonstrate to you that the conclusions that we draw are in fact strong and useful for in your management practices. And then the last thing is again how to implement these things in your practices or in your breeding programs, because each one of you has a little bit different goal, and the implementation of these type of tools is different from the commercial producer all the way up to the seed stock producer. I'm going to come down there.
Because I know I'm not going to be able to point sideways. I can point to the laser at the screen. I'm on the computer there. And am I going to get feedback if I turn this one on?
So, the first is why are these important? And I think if any of you sat in on a discussion by Dr. Talman yesterday, he described this as maybe removing non-conformities from your calf crop, and that begins anywhere from having a dead calf to perhaps having a calf that doesn't perform so well. But I'd take a little bit more general look at that. There are kind of three different generalized categories of how maybe most of us as producers think about how we're going to make money in our production systems. And the top one here is probably unfortunately the one we shoot for, but maybe we shouldn't. But we figure that we're just going to get more and better and produce a better product, and we're going to get more money. And I think that's probably true in most cases, but in the end, we can maybe overdo that a little bit. The second part here is particularly with the high commodity costs last year and the increased cost of production, you know, we start revisiting things like optimization or reduction of inputs versus the output that we get out, and therefore we can increase our margins. But down here in the bottom is, I think, the justification for actually doing the work that we've been doing for the last couple of years in regard to genetic defects. And I look at it from a little bit different perspective. I've heard a lot of things in the last couple of months about a couple of these different defects and the question of what kind of real impact do they have. And one of the statements that's made is, do they have any more impact than our normal calf losses? And I'd like to propose to you that that's the wrong attitude. There really shouldn't be such a thing as normal calf losses. I think if you go into a calving season not aiming for at least 100% of your calf crop, I think that's a little bit defeatist in attitude. And so the idea here is that if we chip away at the bottom of these non-conformers or these calves that may be affected with genetic defects, even if it's 1% a year, in the national cow herd, I think it's something that has value and merit. So I'm going to concentrate, generally speaking, on some recessive defects, and the reason why they deserve more attention is that, of course, because of the recessive nature inheritance, in other words, both parents have to be carriers of the defect in order to produce a calf that is affected. which means that we have normal walking around productive individuals in the population that have the genetics to produce these calves. And then, of course, only a percentage of the time are they going to produce affected calves when they're mated to another carrier. Otherwise, they're never going to produce a calf. And so what the problem that presents is these things can kind of get away from you. And I think that Dr. Talman, again, described it pretty good yesterday in that, we're not very proactive, or typically haven't been very proactive about these kind of conditions. We're reactive, and that reactive nature has to do with the fact that these things can take off on us if we don't put up some kind of a surveillance. And the problem, at least recently here with the last couple defects that we've worked on, is you need to realize that the threat of these genetic defects getting to where it's too late is proportional to the population size. What that means is that the larger the genetic base, the larger foundation of a particular population of animals, every time you use an individual that may be carrying a genetic defect, the chances of them actually producing an affected calf is next to nothing, which means that you can go several generations down the road and never, ever see one of these calves. And then by the time you get four or five or six generations down the road, then, of course, we're in this too late mode. And Dr. Talman yesterday described it as crisis mode. I'd like to say I think that crisis maybe is a state of mind, but certainly there we get into a mode where we're fairly reactive and fairly we get a little bit worked up about some of these things because of the frequency. So over the last, 4 years, we've had quite a bit of experience in our program with genetic defects, and I don't know that's necessarily a reflection of an increasing number of defects, but I think it's a reflection of what we just got done talking about as far as overall population genetics, and at the same time changes in the way that perhaps that we breed cattle, and new tools that we have to make breeding decisions. And a couple of those, a couple of those things are intensity of selection. As we bring new tools online, we can increase the intensity of selection. And unknowingly, or maybe perhaps knowingly, what we're doing is we increase intensity of selection. Even though we're dealing with quantitative traits, we are in fact placing selection on particular regions of the genome and particular genes to try to move our phenotypes in the right direction. And so when we do that, realize that when you select two parent individuals, you're trying to derive the best combination of DNA sequence. You may not think about it that way, but that's what you're doing. And because of that, you may produce combinations that result in homozygosity, which is going to bring out these recessive defects. The other thing is the use of reproductive technology such as AI and EP. And this is not a statement against those technologies, but the fact is that those technologies become more widespread, what happens is we tend to start reducing, I think what was described in one of the talks yesterday as effective population size. And so that also, because of that, begins to increase the overall homozygosity of the population. And anytime you do that, that's not the cause of genetic defects, but that certainly allows them to be expressed. All the talks we had yesterday showed you how we can place direct selection pressure on some of these different markers or SNPs or regions throughout the genome. And I'll probably get some disagreement from maybe some of the presenters yesterday that if we don't watch out for how we use those technologies, perhaps the chances to actually have these genetic defects surface becomes even greater, as that we can actually place selection pressure specifically on DNA segments by incorporating them into our genomic selection. And so the counterbalance to that would be to keep an eye out for increasing homozygosity in populations and perhaps erecting surveillance programs like Dr. Talman talked about yesterday. So I haven't used this slide in a long time, but I think it's fit here. Is that when we come across a genetic defect in the population, we have quite a few choices. We can ignore it, hope it goes away, and we've certainly, there are instances historically that that's happened, and typically what happens, of course, is that they come back to get us again. Some of these genetic defects I'll talk about today, have known histories in breed populations that go back in the 70s and 80s, where actually there was surveillance programs set up and there was actually defect policies put in place because of them, and here we are 25 years later talking about them again, but only because we have new tools to solve the problems. The other part, the second one here is actually an extremely important one and also relates to some of the uses of these technologies after we use the tools we have today to solve these problems. In the 40s and 50s and even a little bit beyond that, of course, the policy was that if you recognized the genetic defect and it was at such a frequency where it was widely recognizable, what you did is you simply cut out the entire pedigree material and tried to eliminate it that way. So there's two problems with that. Is one, pedigrees can be wrong and you're liable to miss one. And two, even if your pedigrees aren't wrong, you're liable to miss one. I guess the third one here is that by doing that, you do remove a significant portion of the gene pool from the population, and that can be overall contradictory to breed improvement. The last one here in the top list is find out cross genetics and breed away from it, and that's a viable option again for a little while. In a purebred situation or a seed stock situation or within a registered breed population, this is probably not the preferred choice either. In the commercial situation, actually, this is not such a bad deal. If we're going to be in a terminal crossbreeding situation, this one works quite well. But from a seed stock or foundation genetic situation, it's probably not the best choice. The last choice here is the one we try to convince you is the appropriate choice, and I think we have, on the next slide I'll show you the proof of principle is how that actually does work, but the real solution to these problems is the accurate identification of carriers and combining that with breeding management, and what I'll spend the next couple minutes doing on these slides is trying to describe how we go about doing that. So you've heard a lot about the technologies in the last couple of days. Particularly, you've heard about the new high-density SNP chips or SNP arrays. And, of course, we wouldn't be probably having this same conversation or the same discussion even a year and a half ago. These methods that we use to do this were, of course, still possible, but I'll give you kind of a time frame when we started out in 97 was the first time that I had worked on a genetic defect, a recessive genetic defect that happened to be in sheep. That population took about 4 years to breed, and then it took us two more years to actually do the genetic analysis, and if it wasn't for somebody doing an experiment in mice, we may still be at it. I don't know. But we're talking 4 or 5 years' time. And nowadays, we've changed that to a couple of months' time. And so these tools are quite powerful. So we can actually go, and there's an important part here, and we'll discuss this when I get to one of the experiments. Again, I'll refer to Dr. Talman's talk yesterday. He proposed the development of a surveillance program where we made use of some inbred matings to produce potentially affected calves if there was a deleterious recessive there. And when it says here, assembly of sufficient material, he described it as being two or three or four calves. And I'll show you some experimental data that actually bear some of that out in regard to the number of the amount of material you need. But the idea here is that as soon as the sufficient materials assembled, the success that you can have is very short term. These are not long drawn out processes. The resulting solutions are very high in accuracy and are, I think, cost effective, and should be continue to become more cost effective as we develop more and more of these high throughput DNA genotyping platforms. What you end up with after you develop these materials is a tool that allows you to manage these problems. And the idea here is to monitor carriers in the population, use the appropriate selection pressure against those individuals, and at the same time make sure that you're not removing genetic variation from the valuable genetic variation from the population. This has received lots of debate over the last couple months, and don't think I'm sitting on the fence there, but in the situations that we've actually got some feedback on, we're talking about a population that has a very large genetic base with high representation of particular individuals, and so I think using these tools to select against some of these traits is putting high pressure on some of these traits is something that is possible. The smaller the population here, the more concern you have to have about the loss of valuable germplasm. The larger the population, the less concern you have to be. So again, the proof of principle. This is not an exhaustive list by any means. But this is a list that we've worked on over the last 4 years. Started in 2003, we started looking at a condition called tibial hemimelia in shorthorns. And in 2004, in 2004 we released a molecular diagnostic for that. Pulmonary hypoplasia with Anasarca followed. This is present in shorthorn populations, this is present in Maine and Jew in shorthorn populations, as well as dextra populations. Idiopathic epilepsy was, these two were took 2 years, and we kind of did them by old-fashioned methodology, or what I refer to as old-fashioned methodology. And then these last five here took about 18 months to 2 years. So it all depends on when you start counting, but as far as the actual DNA work, it's getting a lot faster. Idiopathic epilepsy is a condition that we finished off last May, in May of 2008. Of course, arthropathosis multiplex is one that was just last fall. Shortly after that one, it didn't get a lot of press, but shortly after arthropathosis multiplex, or AM, we found the mutation for hypertrichosis, which is an issue in Hereford cattle that we estimate has been around since probably the 1950s. That work was done in association with the University of Missouri-Columbia. Osteopetrosis is one that was just released here, I think March 23rd, and is kind of approved or used in the Red Angus breed, even though there's a long history of this condition also being present in Black Angus cattle, but that was a joint effort between USDA Mark and Bark and ourselves and University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And then the most recent one, which I'll actually show you some experimental results for, is this neuropathic hydrocephalus. And so the idea here is that we don't work on these things unless they're brought to us. And in the end, when we provide a solution, I can actually tell you that industry uptake of technology has been high, and it's not been because of rules or policies put in place by any organization. It's because whenever these things are brought to us, there's a demonstrated need. And I always go back to our initial start in this was the reason why we worked on tibial hemimelia was because the veterinarian in Indiana that started bringing us pictures of calves and tissues on calves, he had heard that I'd done some sheep work 7 or 8 years earlier, and he thought that these calves looked an awful lot like the sheep that I'd worked on, and he wondered if I was interested in doing it because his embryo transplant practice, they were using cow families and bulls at every farm he would go around and visit. He'd have to take care of one of these calves, and he was absolutely sure by doing his own pedigree searches that it was genetic and wanted us to do something about it. And so each one of these things is to us, there's been a demonstrated need for a solution, and because of that, I think in the end, we've had relatively high uptake from an industry standpoint. So I'll talk to you about, like I said, I'd like to alleviate maybe the mystery about how we go about these things, about setting these things, and so I'd like to use this example of the most recent one that we've tried to tackle. And the name is new. It was referred to as hydrocephalus only a couple months ago. But the great thing about hindsight is that you can always change the name to more appropriately reflect the condition. And so now we call this one neuropathic hydrocephalus, and I'll explain why that is as we go through this. So again, we see a demonstrated need to work on these things. What happened in this case was that in the middle of the work that we were doing for AM, for arthrogryposis multiplex or curly calf, there had been a request for the submission of affected calves, or calves that had succumbed, or calves that had died or been born dead due to AM. And in fact, in the release in September about AM, there was mention of pedigree material where there was a common ancestor that was present, and we were looking for specifically dead calves out of matings that had that common ancestor. And so we began to get plenty of dead calves, plenty of reports on dead calves, some historical, some fresh. And probably by about the first week in November or second week in November, we began to accumulate a subset of calves that in fact, didn't look at all like the typical curly calves, the AM calves. They all had features that looked like this. This is just the head of the calf. So this is, the body would be out here, but this is the head. You can see the size of it. This is about a basketball-sized one. There's severe malformation of the jaw and the mouth here, and that's because of the contortion of the skull, because of the increased pressure due to the fluid that builds up in the brain here or in the skull. It's characterized by, of course, lethality. None of these are born alive. It's also quite uniquely characterized by the absence of central nervous system tissue. So if you actually open the brain of these, or open the skull of these individuals up, you see the absence of brain tissue and you see absence of spinal cord tissue. That's not anything, it uniquely describes this type of hydrocephalus. But in more detail, there's actually peripheral nerve tissue in these animals. And what that means is that at one time there was a brain and at one time there was a spinal cord, but it's been degenerated or degraded. And that's this neuropathic part. So the renaming has to do with the fact that we actually know from the function of the gene that the brain was there, but because of the problem with this gene, it goes away, and the hydrocephalus is actually a secondary effect of a cerebral spinal fluid accumulation in the skull. So one of the things we try to do when we look at these is to take a real careful look about why we get this pathology. And I'm not a pathologist by any means. I have a great collaborator in Dave Steffen at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. I'd like to think he's as good as a veterinary pathologist as I am a molecular biologist. And so it either works great together or we're both fooling ourselves and we're not as good as we think. But so he does all the pathology work and he gives me insight to what he thinks is going wrong. And I do the DNA work and I ask him to look for different things that I think could be going wrong based on the mutations that we find in genes. I think part of the confusion, the reason why this one went unnoticed for quite a while, and I'll share more data with you in a minute about what mutations in this gene probably do, But you notice here one of the last features of this pathology is something called mild arthrogryposis. Of course, that's the name of our other condition, is arthrogryposis multiplex. When you look at the reason behind, the physiological reason behind arthrogryposis is caused by a deficit of neurological muscle interaction. In AM, the gene that's responsible for the defect is one of those things that makes that connection. In this case, we have no central nervous system and no spinal cord, so there's no nerves to connect with the muscle. And so, in fact, you wind up with a very similar phenotype. So it wouldn't be unrealistic for me to suggest that arthrogryposis is diagnosed as arthrogryposis and that these two kind of calves could actually be misdiagnosed or confused with one another without proper education about what could be going on. So I really kind of believe that some of these calves were actually diagnosed as arthrogryposis calves, and that's why we began to see them trickle into the laboratory as examples. Well, what happens is it's fine to see, you know, you see one or two, and you can push that off as sporadic appearance of a condition like this. But then when you start getting 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then by the end of January, we're up to about 14 reports. And by that time, we had released the test for arthrogryposis multiplex, and some of these were beginning to be born out of matings that were between parents that were negative for that mutation. And so that rose a pretty red flag. Believe it or not, at that time, we still really had absolutely no evidence that this was genetic. Okay? The reason for that is that we had already asked for cooperation on the behalf of breeders to report these dead calves, and furthermore, we'd kind of exaggerated the problem by asking for calves that were of a particular pedigree. And so, in fact, all these calves had similar common ancestors to what we'd already worked on with AM, and so, in fact, we could not in any way clearly define that this was a genetic condition, although we had quite a few of them with the same phenotype with broad geographical distribution and recessive inheritance, if you assume the ancestor might be the same, did fit quite nicely. The beauty of today's technology is you can actually ask these questions the other way around. Okay, we usually define the trait as a genetic trait, define it by looking at matings that say this must be a recessive genetic trait, and then ask the question as to how do we find the gene that's involved. In this case, like I said, we didn't have clear evidence, but by using the high-density marker arrays, we can take these two different groups of animals, and in this case, this is almost a kind of a copy of the slide that I used for arthrogryposis multiplex, or AM. But at the time we ran this analysis in mid-February, we only had access to 6 DNA samples on dead calves. We actually had 9 calves in the lab, but 3 of the DNA samples were in such bad shape that we couldn't get good enough DNA out of them. In contrast to AM, we did have veterinary pathology on all these calves and parent verification on all the calves. We used the same 10 control samples that we used in the AM study. We actually used 11 in the AM study, but we removed one more when we did this one because we thought it was too closely related to the pedigree material. And then we ran them across the SNP 50 array that you've heard about numerous times yesterday and even yesterday, I guess, most. So this look again also looks very similar to a slide that I show about AEM, but this is kind of shows you perhaps how clear the evidence is that it maps to a single locus, and I'll explain some of these other peaks here in a minute, but the idea here, this is a statistical distribution of the influence or the association with particular SNPs all across the genome, and so the higher this number is, the more significantly associated with the condition they are. And we do a secondary analysis besides this, but that helps alleviate some of these other problems out here. But if you attended Dr. Talman's lecture yesterday, he suggested that with 2 or 3 calves, you could get you could narrow it down to at least 2 or 3 segments of chromosomes, and you could place appropriate selection pressure on those segments without defining the mutation. The reason why I show this one with only six is because it was the first one that we did, but it actually shows you how you can get signals other places in the genome. Okay? And so they're in using six individuals against the 10, there would actually be 1, 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 places in the genome that I might guess that this particular gene was. However, the second analysis that we actually do asks whether or not all these calves are homozygous. So in other words, remember the question that we were asking, is it genetic, is it controlled by a single gene, and does that gene require homozygosity to produce the affected phenotype? And when you look across all these other ones where these peaks are high or look to be higher than the rest of them, this is the only one that qualifies for that. So here we've asked the question in reverse. We said we have this group of calves. They all have a similar phenotypic or similar phenotype. They all have the same pathology. Is this a genetic trait? Is it recessive? And the answer is yes. And like I said, hopefully this demonstrates to you that it actually takes very little material to do this. And I think this is very consistent with some of the proposals that Dr. Talman made yesterday in his discussion. So this won't mean too much, but you heard a lot of talk probably the last couple of days about the size of the genome. So we have a genome that's 3 gigabases or 3,000 megabases or 3 billion DNA base pairs, however you want to describe it. It's important here to recognize the resolution of these technologies just to start off with a first pass. So with those 6 calves, comparing them against the other 10, we actually reduced it from 3,000 megabases down to 6.6 megabases. And so this is where we're going to depart a little bit from what Dr. Talman talked about. What he was discussing yesterday was the ability to take markers within an interval like this and use those markers to incorporate into a selection paradigm where you can put negative selection pressure on the segment of the chromosome without necessarily finding the exact mutation. And so this gives you an idea. 6 calves against the other 10 reduces it down to about 2%, less than 2% of the genome, okay, or 0.2% of the genome. So that's pretty good, but this is actually quite a, that's probably pretty sizable region for, I think pretty sizable region. There's a lot of other genes in 6.6 megabases that you may not want to select against. So what this results in is a rapid identification of a marker haplotype, and this is the point at which we could incorporate selection if we had a mechanism to do that. So from the time the DNA samples were collected and ran on the chip to the time that we could come up with a marker haplotype was about 2 weeks. Okay, so it's a huge change from the old way we would do it. So, but that gives you an idea of how quickly these things can be approached. We use that marker haplotype actually, and we've gotten even better at this over last year. But to actually use that marker haplotype to screen the entire population for animals that look like they're homozygous for the haplotype, but of course are alive. And it actually turns out to be a real neat exercise. And when you go to sequence animals that are living yet homozygous for this haplotype, it turns out that if they truly are identical by descent, they only differ at the particular mutation, which is quite a phenomenal. When you get that kind of data back, it's quite conclusive. Then we proceed to resequencing. So because we have a completed genome sequence, I'm sure some of you saw that in the press last week. We of course had working sequence for now on 4 or 5 years now, but of course the completed assemblies and a couple different versions of that were published here just last week, and there was a number of big press releases. But once you have it narrowed down to the small interval, you can go in, you can identify the genes that are within there to sequence. And that's not a perfect science either. You go through and you read a whole lot of literature on a whole lot of genes that you really don't necessarily care anything about. But you're looking for genes that would, in fact, cause the problem that you're seeing in these calves. And then we go in and resequence the DNA sequence for those genes in animals of known genotypes. In other words, we select animals that are IBD for the haplotype, but we know must be only carriers. We select animals that we know are from are affected calves. We select known carriers. We select known normal individuals by marker haplotype, and then we go in and sequence all those individuals. In this particular case, we identified only one SNP, or one single nucleotide polymorphism. A little bit of, I guess, more fundamental science here. We call, in this particular case, the SNP is something we call a non-synonymous substitution. What this means is that the change in the DNA sequence changes the protein produced from this gene. And so it doesn't say the same thing. Non-synonymous doesn't mean the same thing. So this DNA change changes the amino acid sequence of the protein. And in this case, it actually turns out to change the amino acid sequence in what we call a conserved functional domain. And I had a slide in here that actually showed you the protein sequence. And I thought maybe that was a little bit over the top. So I'll try to get the point across, but this conserved functional domain here is actually conserved all the way from bacteria through fungi through plants to vertebrates. What that means is the gene and the protein sequence encoded by that gene is virtually identical all the way from bacteria to vertebrates. Okay, and the implication here is this is an important piece of DNA. So if you change it, it causes problems. And so because of its importance, there's a huge amount of selection pressure for maintaining the DNA sequence within the genome of these organisms. So that's our first thing. It's non-synonymous. It's in a conserved functional domain. That functional domain is conserved over many, many millions of years, hundreds of millions of years of evolutionary divergence. So that's supporting evidence. We actually have a method in molecular biology or molecular genetics called the knockout. And a knockout, this has been around for about 20 years. We have the ability to go in and manipulate the genetic material of the mouse through embryonic stem cells and through recombinant DNA. And so you can actually modify or you can change the functionality of particular genes by targeted knockout. And this gene actually has been knocked out in mice, which means that there are mice that don't have the gene. When you breed those mice to homozygosity, you get 100% fetal demise by day 8 of gestation. In mice, gestation is 21 days, so all of these fetuses abort by day 8. And so that supplies a little bit of information. So damage to this particular gene causes damage to the organism. So an interesting note here, and this is just a side note, and I put it in here because I think it's the only place it fits. What's actually known in the knockout mouse is that heterozygotes for the mouse knockout actually have pronounced irritability and hyperactivity, which is something that we're going to maybe pay attention to from a phenotype standpoint in possible carrier animals. Another point of data that was extremely important to us is that these putative common ancestor in this case, we actually had access to DNA material from his parents. And in fact, both individuals were homozygous normal for the mutation. And of course, by DNA verification, they are in fact confirmed as the parents of that individual. So what that actually tells us is that the mutation actually occurred in the individual's germline in that generation. So the last part is the population study, and we do this for every one of the conditions that we work on. The idea here is that if the mutation is in fact not the cause of mutation and not lethal in nature, we're going to find animals that are homozygous for this mutation in the population. And the proportion of animals that you have to do to prove that goes up depending on the frequency of the mutation in the population. But We've now done a little over 4,000 animals, and there are 830 animals that are heterozygous for the mutation and 3,378 that are homozygous, and we have zero that are homozygous for the deleterious allele, and the 21 DNA samples that are dead that are from affected calves are all homozygous for the mutation. So I think pretty compelling evidence. Well, by the end of the next week, we'll be well over 6,000 animals, and I think we'll be done. And I mean, I think we're done now, but we're going to go ahead and do the other 3,000 that we got. So, and that hopefully tells you the process. I know there's questions about this one, and that's probably the only way. There's only one slide in here on this one. I've been asked a couple of times while I've been here what the status of this is. There's another condition that we're investigating that's been under investigation in Australia for 3 or 4 years now. And it's referred to by the Australians as fawn calf syndrome. I call it a semi-lethal trait in that calves that look like this certainly have a difficult time managing by themselves. You notice this calf is in a pen. So after he was born, his mother and he were brought up in a pen so that they could help him around and get him nursed. This is a calf that was born in Montana. My guess is that he would have died fairly shortly after he was born if he wasn't paid special attention to. So the fact that it can cause death, we call it semi-lethal. It's described by joint laxity and joint contracture, so you notice that he kind of can't get up. The pasterns are kind of curled up, and he can't stand up because of the flexibility in the joints. He can't get his feet underneath him. It's either a neurological or a connective tissue defect, but the truth be told, we've not actually seen enough tissue, joint tissue, or nerve tissue on a lot of these calves to actually make that call, but there's clearly something wrong with them. Same thing, the Australians have actually suggested by their data that this is recessive for a couple years now, and because of the some debate over whether or not it really was in fact genetic or was recessive, we did an independent analysis with the calves collected here in the States. We've actually collected 12 calves so far that we believe were truly fawns, and in fact we can confirm the same way we did with hydrocephalus that it is a recessive trait, maps to a single locus within the genome, and all 12 calves are homozygous for a 3 megabase interval or 3 million base pair interval on the chromosome. And if we look at haplotype analysis, which we're currently doing, it's fairly low to moderate frequency in the population. And we've got, of course, more work to do on that before we continue on. But we're moving forward with that one. It is clearly genetic, and hopefully we'll have a resolution here in the next couple of weeks. So the producer application part, and that's kind of what I guess I was to spend most of the time on, but I'll do it in kind of summary, is that the application of these technologies actually really differs based on where you're at in the production system. The suggestion is that if you're responsible for the production of seed stock that is going to go out and be multiplied in the commercial industry or using the commercial industry for the production of calves, I think most of the responsibility falls on you to manage that as best you can so that it doesn't trickle out into the commercial population. And so from the amount of management required, the seed stock producer probably has the biggest responsibilities and the biggest management effort associated with those responsibilities. A commercial producer with replacement, this means a producer that actually is going out buying purebred seed stock, even if it's two different breeds, even if you're taking, you're in a crossbreeding situation where you buy terminal sires and put on a different breed of cows, if you're keeping your own replacement females, whether it be something like F1 Baldies or even cattle down that was just talked about in Alabama, got a little bit of ear in them. If you're keeping your females and there's a potential genetic defect in the population, you're committed to manage that female base. Otherwise, you're going to get into this calf loss situation. And then commercial terminal, there's little or no risk, particularly if you're in a crossbreeding situation, and particularly if you know a little bit about the female base of your cow herd. You just need to make sure that you're using an animal that is negative for the appropriate situation that you're in. If you're in a crossbreeding situation, you know, it probably makes little difference whether or not you're using a negative or positive animal. But you have to have a commitment to make sure that these are all terminal animals, or you're in this category here where you have a commercial commitment to manage those replacement females. There's also consideration on the use of the technology and expense versus outcome. You know, and so I've got them ranked here kind of the opposite way. We had seed stock down to commercial producer on the last slide. In this case, we're probably going to talk about the commercial producer being at this point where he's going to have low to no cost, or he might pay a little bit of premium for a sire that's guaranteed to be negative for a particular genetic defect. But if he does that, then he's going to have the guarantee that there's going to have no affected calves born. And so he's probably going to ask his seed stock producer to provide test information on that bull, and he may be willing to provide, like I said, a premium price to do that because he knows he's not going to have any calf loss associated with at least these genetic defects. The second is more of a moderate cost, and this is the management of, again, probably having to deal with either both bulls and cows that are going to be carriers in your herd, but there's no need to do it necessarily all at once. We all have bulls that are going to sire maybe the majority of our calves, or herd matriarchs that are going to produce the majority of our replacements. And if we're going to reduce our cost for genetic testing, we're going to concentrate on our high-impact individuals and perhaps other individuals as they move into the cow herd. And if the situation between your herd matriarchs and your replacement heifers holds true, you've eliminated the testing of these replacement heifers by already testing their dams and testing their sires. So we have moderate costs associated, upfront costs associated with that, with perhaps some annual costs associated with replacement of replacement heifers. And, of course, the highest cost is complete management, where we're going to test all the animals in the herd. We're going to understand what their status is. Again, here I'll remind that this does not necessarily imply elimination, only management, but I think the direction of movement should certainly be in the direction of elimination. So I think part of the reason that I guess probably I was asked to come here, and Dr. Talman was asked to give maybe a little bit different aspect of how the most current technology can help us with these situations. Again, I'll fall back on the premise that the reason why we need to look at these things is because if we're looking to increase our margins, or at least reduce our loss and increase our margins that way, we really need to have an effort to actually take care of these things. And I think we're going to potentially see more of this occur in the future as we move toward the use of these new technologies. We have to participate in things like we're doing today, education, understand what the process is, how it works, and that, in fact, it can be relatively painless if we keep on top of it and put the proper programs in place. Some of what has happened over the last 6 months has been extremely refreshing in that we've changed the psychology of breeders toward genetic defects, and that because we can provide such rapid solutions to these defects, we get more compliance with reporting, which allows us the material to actually provide solutions to the problem. What I'd hate for that to hate to happen is to see that psychology change, and over the last month or so, there's been an undercurrent of perhaps we just keep hiding these behind the barn and not say anything anymore. And it disappoints me a little bit, but we have to keep from slipping back into maybe our old ways. We need to set up a system where we can get standardized reporting processes. Dr. Stefan and I, again, we work pretty well together and closely together. But some of the things Dr. Talman talked about yesterday, I'll call the re-implementation of old protocols, sire daughter matings or inbred matings to perhaps keep a handle on these things as we move forward with these other technologies. And you know, I think that Dr. Steph and I would welcome the opportunity to do this, but it's not our place to say what should happen as far as industry-wide reporting, et cetera. And I think that's probably a position the BIF can certainly play a role in, and we'd be certainly happy to assist. But if we're going to be serious about this, as Dr. Talman said the other day, it's going to require a little bit of investment, and we're going to have to go big or not go at all. And I think the argument should be that we should go big. But what that means is we're going to actually have either, like he discussed, either service capabilities to actually service sire-daughter mating or monitor sire-daughter mating experiments, collection of DNA, and feedback to either breed associations or DNA companies, et cetera, in order to get all this facilitated. So the last slide here, I think, other than the acknowledgments is that, you know, again, I'm not up here saying that we ought to spend millions and millions and millions of dollars on this stuff, but I think that the preventative dollars that can be put into programs like I just talked about, surveillance programs, inbreeding programs, central DNA repositories, coordination efforts, is certainly well worth the dollars in the end to not have something spread throughout a population until it reaches a frequency we're at the too late stage. And so again, this be this proactive attitude toward doing this. And if we take that, I think that it's not going to be a problem, and that we certainly have solutions to all these. The last one here is just acknowledgments. I have three pretty good people in the lab. Brandy's done a lot of the work. Stacy Myers did the work on osteopetrosis with collaborators from USDA Mark and Bark. And of course, like I said, the pathologist that we've been working with is Dr. Stefan. I think he's on retainer for most of breed associations, so he certainly should be recognized as one of the premier pathologists. We couldn't do our work without the associations. Lista Markey did the hypertrichosis work, and that chip work was done at University of Missouri, and she analyzed it and found the mutation. We couldn't do it without the funding we have. We actually have a pretty good program through CSRES and ARS to actually do this stuff, so just some acknowledgments, but to finish it up here, and I'd be happy to take questions.
We have time to take about two questions, and we're getting into break.
You said most of these traits are recessive. Do you know of any that are?
Well, so just
recessive you can get rid of, but.
So that's just to describe there are other conditions or other, I think, phenotypes that have economic impact that are considered defects or classified as defects that certainly have dominant modes of inheritance or other modes of inheritance. Those are relatively easy to get rid of. I mean, not only can you see it in the parent individual, but you certainly can see it in the offspring given the right mating. I mean, a great example of that is actually Galuter. You don't necessarily see it in red-hided cattle, but when you put that individual on black-hided cattle, you see it quite readily in one generation. It doesn't require both parents to be. And so the recessive ones, you know, there are probably other complex inheritance patterns for some of these things that I'm sure we'll get into with, as we proceed along these lines. Like Dr. Talman talked about yesterday, there's going to be some lack of performance or some normal inbreeding depression issues that may come up if we implement these surveillance programs. Those probably, a lot of those may not be simple in inheritance. They may not be simple recessive. They may be a cumulative effect across the genome. But most of these are recessive, which makes them dangerous. But there are other classes.
What was the process of final triggers that the industry finally recognized we had to pay them for?
So it depends on whose final trigger. I can speak to my final trigger, and I don't know if it answers it for everybody involved in the process. But like I said, we take on these projects due to interest from some party. And in this particular case for AM, the interest was based on a commercial producer that was the neighbor of a fellow Hereford breeder that also had Angus cattle. And after we had finished idiopathic epilepsy in the spring of 2008, I received a phone call and he said, "Hey, you just got done with the idiopathic epilepsy. Can you come look at these cattle or can you look at some pedigrees?" And I said, "Well, yeah, we're happy to do anything." And from that point on, we got continued evidence that there was a circulating genetic problem. And that evidence never went away. It continued to build. And, you know, in the end, after the first request for calves in September, you know, when you get 48 reports in a week, that's pretty significant, I think.
As a follow-up, I have a problem with those steps. And as a commercial producer, recognize quickly I have a problem. So I sent one calf to the diagnostic lab, one state, got a report back to the construction block committee. I just had to accept it. Continued to have problems. Immediately the next week brought another calf to another state, got another issue. And, you know, just pull calves the rest of the season. And then a year and a half later, you know, I'll see what I have to do, maybe, you know, without what you jumped off the page. I was just wondering, from a commercial producer, what I see is genetic defects, and it can happen to any type of herd, but when you have something that you obviously know isn't normal, I did the only thing I knew to do. I mean, I was dealing with both my vets, two different state labs, and getting back information. I didn't know if they were clearing house or there's any other way to disseminate information. It just could have been caught quicker.
And that,
that's
unfortunately, I mean, that's why we start bringing up discussions of these programs, central management programs, whether they be through, you know, via associations or via state labs or. And unfortunately, we're in a situation where we are being reactive again. You're right, we need a better system. I wouldn't pretend to get up here and tell you what that system might be to be able to catch all these things. But I do know and I can empathize that the system doesn't work. I mean, well, it hasn't in the past. I mean, it's working now, and the reason why it's working, I think, is in part due to demonstrated success. I mean, you know, the rumor mill circulates enough to where they say, you know, "I've called this person, I've called this person, I've called this person, and, you know, then I call you, and is this something I need to be concerned about?" We need to get all that funneled into either, you know, through the breed association to an individual like Dr. Stephan or to me or to somebody else that's willing to assume that responsibility and that role to get a system that really does work. But you're right. I mean, you go to your local vet. Your local vet knows that he might want to test it for some viral pathogen. If he can't answer the question, he might want to send it to a state lab. You know, the typical mindset perhaps of that state lab is again getting back to that original mindset of, if you go into a calf crop expecting to lose 1 or 2%, I think it's the wrong idea. But if you submit your calf to a state lab and the expectation is, yeah, 90% of these cases are environmental, and, you know, I can't find BVD, so I'm going to write a report that says, "Sorry, you lost a dead calf, and this is what it had." And we need to really work on that.
And here's your bill.
Yeah, I mean, so you're right. I mean, we need an organized, structured system to do that, but, you know, I think we have heightened awareness about it, because even if we put the surveillance plan in place, I'll disagree with one of the people one of my colleagues that answered the question yesterday. If we put one of these surveillance plans in place where we're actually doing some sire dire matings on popular bulls, I'm going to suggest that I don't think very many of them will come up positive. Okay? Most of them will probably pass their 35 sire daughter matings and move on. And the only thing that does is gives us a false sense of security, and then after about 4 or 5 years of doing that, you know what we'll do? We'll stop doing it and the whole structure will fall apart. And then you know what will happen 10 years from now? we'll be back again. So yeah, we think we have a system. The system clearly doesn't work, but I guess the only suggestion I can have is when you hit a wall, just keep going until you don't hit one. And I know it's tough, but well, most of these things are restricted to different populations. So, and the technology that you've heard about, I don't know if it'll be something that'll ever happen, but the suggestion is that when we're doing things like testing for 384 SNPs or 384 markers or 1,536 markers, that the majority of these high-impact ones that need surveillance from now until the next 5 years get placed on there, and there'll be a mechanism to cycle those off if there are new ones as we improve the population status for these defects. But, you know, right now there's not a need for all the defects we tested for in any one individual. Just a few of them, because we know where the pedigree source is and we know what population is present in. So there are some breeds, there are some populations that require one or two now, and potentially another one. But the Hereford population, within the next 3 or 4 months, most of the Hereford things will be done for all three, diluter, epilepsy, and hypertrichosis, all at once. So we're moving that direction. The gold standard is 35.
$35.
You can get to 99% with 24. And if you can get to 24, you might get enough calves to do what Dr. Talman talked yesterday and what I showed you today. So, my opinion, I wouldn't go less than 24, but you might be able to do it with 16, but the gold standard is 35, and that there's a good reason for that.
We'll go ahead and continue to take questions, because it looks like there's a lot of interest in this. For those of you who like to join the break, it's going on outside. It'll be.
I'm going for break.
Is the motor test commercially available now?
Yes. Either Maxim Analytics or I oversee a laboratory that does it.
Okay. Another question.
And it should be available through, do I have the right persons in the room? I don't think it's on as high as the other one up there, but we got an Igenity representative here. I think they have the DNA sequence information. I think Pfizer might have it too. Not that I know of.
Another question, in a case like, for example, a common cold head mouth or retinacea, short lower jaw, and some of the old literature is called a recessive, but there was some work done by a graduate student of Dr. Leipold where they did ferret mouth molds and put them together, and you could get all ferret mouth fragments.
I think it's one of those things, how you ask the question. So parrot mouth actually, in other species, has never been demonstrated to be a recessive trait. It's actually been demonstrated to be a more complex trait than single locus. And if cattle would follow, then we would expect it to be similar. But I think with today's technology, if we're talking about technology we had even 18 months ago, it'd be a tough problem to solve. You'd be talking about doing breeding experiments and really doing a lot of work to get to the bottom of something like that. But to be truthful, the beauty of this technology is that you shouldn't be afraid to ask a question. For, you know, $3,000 to $5,000 and the right DNA samples, you can ask the question. And you may not get the answer that you want, and you may be out $5,000 worth of research dollars. But I wouldn't be in any way hesitant to try something like that with today's technology.
Have they found, actually, doing research on sheep or any other mammals, is that
it's not frequent enough in humans, and I've not seen any mouse models that have broken out of this.
So. What about one more question?
Sure. Yeah. Which one? I think those are different. I think those are different, and somebody's inquired about doing it, but again, it just requires samples. We need to sit down at a table and say, what are the best samples that can be used to actually take a look at that? And if we can sit down and do that, and we can get the DNA samples again, if there's need or if there's desired need, we're happy to take a look.
And the cost would be?
Right now we're happy, but these experiments cost, you know, $200 a chip. You know, we do 20, 25 animals. They cost $5,000 to $10,000, and then if we have to do a bunch of sequencing after that, it all depends on how aggressive we have to get. I mean, if we have to do things like we might have to do here in the next week or so, we'll spend $10,000 on sequencing in the next week. But I hope we don't have to do that. But.